Chapter 6. It was with a feeling not unlike dread that Stephen followed Mrs. Wogan into Franchon's hotel. The people behind the desk were talking French, and this, together with the European atmosphere of the place, brought about an odd shift in his sense of time and country. He had not seen Diana Villiers for a great while, yet it was much as though he were returning to the field of yesterday's encounter, an action from which he might have retired intensely happy, or with a lacerated heart. She had treated him abominably at times. He dreaded the meeting, and he had got ready for it 2 hours before the appointed time. He rarely shaved more than once or twice a week, nor did he pay much attention to his linen, but now he was wearing the finest shirt that Boston could afford, and the keen, though foggy, Boston air had so heightened the colour of his double-shaved face that it was no longer its usual lifeless olive brown, but a glowing pink. They were shown upstairs into an elegant drawing-room, and there was Mr. Johnson. Stephen had not seen him for many years, and then only once. The American had ridden up to Diana's house in Alipur on perhaps the most beautiful horse that ever was. He had been denied, and he had ridden away again. A tall, capable-looking man, handsome, too, though now there was something of a paunch, something of a jowl, that had been lacking in the young horseman on the chestnut mare. A lively eye, and somewhat licorous. A Jovian temperament, no doubt. How much did he know of Stephen's former relationship with Diana? Stephen had asked himself that question before. Now, while Johnson was greeting Mrs. Wogan, he asked it again. Mrs. Wogan made the introductions, and Johnson turned all his attention upon Stephen, looking at him, as he bowed, with particular interest, and as it were, benevolence, a kind, polite, and deferential look. He was obviously a man of very good company, and he had an agreeable way of making his interlocutor seem a person of real importance.
"I am exceedingly happy to meet Dr. Maturin," he said. "Mrs. Wogan and Mr. Herapath have often spoken of your kindness during their voyage, and I believe you have been acquainted with my friend Mrs. Villiers since she was a girl. And even more than that, sir, it is to you that we are indebted for the splendid monography on boobies."
Stephen said that Mr. Johnson was too kind, too indulgent by far, yet it was a fact that in the matter of boobies he had been more fortunate than most men. The merit, if merit there were, lay in circumstances, not in himself. He had been marooned on a tropical island during the height of their breeding season, and he had of necessity grown intimate with most of the species.
"We are very poor in boobies, alas," said Johnson. "With great good fortune, when I was off the Dry Tortugas, I managed to secure one of the blue-faced sort, but the white-bellied I have never seen, far less your red-legged species, or the spotted Peruvian."
"Yet, on the other hand, you have your skimmers, you have your wonderfully curious Aninga."
They talked of the birds of America, those of the Antarctic and the East Indies, for some time, and it became apparent to Stephen that in spite of his modest disclaimers, Johnson knew a good deal. He might not be a scientific observer, he knew little or nothing of their anatomy, but there was no doubt that he loved the creatures. He spoke in much the same slow, soft voice as Mrs. Wogan, rather like a negro, yet this did not conceal his enthusiasm when they came to the great albatrosses, which he had seen when she was going to India. She, for her part, listened to them for a while, then lapsed into a good-tempered silence, gazing out of the window at the people passing by below, dim in the swirling fog. Eventually she walked right out onto the balcony.
"When I learned that there was a possibility of meeting you," said Johnson, bringing a portfolio from beside his desk, "I put these in my baggage."
They were extraordinarily exact and delicate paintings of American birds, among them the Aninga.
"And here is the very fowl you were speaking of," said Johnson, when they reached it. "Do let me beg you to accept it, as some slight acknowledgement of the pleasure your monography gave me."
Polite but steady refusal. Johnson urged the picture's trifling commercial value. He would be ashamed to say how little he gave the artist, but he was too well-bred to insist beyond a certain point, and they moved on to the painter himself.
"A young Frenchman I met on the Ohio River, a Creole, very talented, very difficult. I should have ordered a great many more, but unhappily we fell out. He was a bastard, and bastards, as no doubt you have observed, are often more touchy than ordinary beings. One sometimes offends them without meaning to, and sometimes, indeed, they seem to trail their coats.
Stephen was himself a bastard, and at the word his hackles rose, yet he could not but admit the justice of the remark, and what was much more to the point, a man as polite as Johnson would never have made it if he had known that it could have any present application. Clearly, Diana had been discreet, uncommonly discreet, since a friend's bastardy, divorce, or deformity were so often the earliest point of description, the earliest sacrifice to the candour of intimacy. A servant came in and spoke to Johnson in a low tone.
"You will excuse me for 2 minutes, Dr. Maturin," he said. "Just for 2 minutes, while I get rid of these people."
"By all means," said Stephen. "And in the meantime, I believe I shall pay my respect to Mrs. Villiers, for I understand that she is in the same hotel."
"Oh, yes, yes. Do, she will be delighted. Hers is the red door at the end," said Johnson on the threshold. "Straight down the corridor. You will find your way. I stand on no ceremony with you, as you see, my dear sir. I will join you as soon as I have sent these men away."
Along the passage, the last steps quite slow, and a pause before the red door. He tapped, heard a voice, and walked in. He had unconsciously composed his face so that it bore a civil, unassuming, old acquaintance look, and he was surprised to find the effort that had been required when the expression fell apart on his seeing not Diana, but a black woman weighing 20 stone.
"Mrs. Villiers, if you please," he said.
"What name shall I say, sir?"
asked the black woman, smiling at him from her splendid height and bulk.
"Stephen!" cried Diana, running in. "Oh, how glad I am to see you at last!"
The same step, the same voice, and he felt the same blow about his heart. He kissed her warm, dry hand, and felt its responding pressure. She was telling the black woman to hurry down and bring up the best pot of coffee that Madame Franchon could make.
"And some cream, Polly?"
The veil of tears cleared from his eyes. He recovered his composure and said,
"What a magnificent creature!"
"Yes, yes," said Diana, in a kind of quick parenthesis, holding his hands and looking him full in the face.
"Johnson has dozens like that. He breeds the house slaves for size. Stephen, you have come at last. I was so afraid you might not. I waited in all the morning, had everyone denied."
She drew him nearer and kissed him.
"You did not get my note? Stephen, sit down. You are looking quite pale. How are you, and how is poor Aubrey? The coffee will be here directly."
"No note, Villiers."
"Was it discreet?"
"Oh, just compliments and begged you would call."
"Listen, my dear. Johnson will be here in a minute. What does he know about us?"
At another time, this question would probably have received a very fierce and disconcerting answer. But now she only said,
"Nothing, old acquaintance, practically childhood friends. Oh, Stephen, how glad I am to see you, and to see a British uniform, and to hear a British voice. I was so sorry, so very sorry, about Clarges Street and all that wild dashing out of town, out of England, without even seeing you."
The coffee came, with cream and petit four, and as she poured it out, so she poured out her words, pell-mell. The Leopard's Voyage, the wreck on Desolation Island, news of it all from Louisa Wogan, this dreadful, dreadful war, her mad decision to go back to the States. The loss of Guerriere, Macedonian, Java. How was Jack Aubrey bearing it? With Polly's return, she had switched into French, and with astonishment Stephen observed that she was calling him Tu. He was astonished, too, by her loquacity. Both she and her cousin Sophie had always talked at a great pace, but now Diana's words tumbled over one another, few sentences reached their end, and the connecting association of ideas was at times so tenuous that although he knew her very well, he could scarcely follow. It was as though she had recently taken some stimulant, which so hastened her mental processes that they outran even her outstanding powers of articulation. He had known her in a great variety of moods, friendly, confidential, perhaps even loving for one short period, certainly, and for much longer periods, indifferent, impatient at his long, dumb importunity, sometimes exasperated, hard, and even, though more through the force of circumstances than her own volition, very cruel. But never in this. He had the strangest impression that she was clinging to him, and yet, no, not to him, but to some ideal personage who happened to have the same name, or at least to a mixture of this shadow and himself. And quite apart from that, there was some essential change. He felt the edge of a desperate coldness overcome his first agitation as she talked and as he covertly examined her, sipping his good coffee. The last time he had seen her, he had been struck by the brilliance of her complexion. Now it was comparatively dull. Otherwise, in spite of the years, there was little physical change. Still the same splendid carriage of her head, the same great, misty, dark blue eyes, the same black hair sweeping up. Yet there was some lack that he could not define, some discordancy. His eye moved beyond her to one of the many tall looking-glasses in the room, and he saw her fine straight back, the perfect rise of her neck, the graceful movement of her hands, and in the reflection he also saw himself, a squat figure in the small gilt chair, looking crushed. He pulled himself upright, and as she said, with a smile, "Why, Stephen, where is your tongue?" He heard steps outside and murmured, "In English now, my dear." The door opened and Mrs. Wogan walked in, followed by Johnson. The women kissed each other. Madame Franchon and her tiny husband brought another pot of coffee, received congratulations on their petit four. A general din of talk, and what seemed like a great crowd of people. Polly, reaching behind Johnson for an empty cup, dropped it on the floor. Johnson whipped round, and Stephen saw her face turn grey as she stared in naked terror, her arms down by her sides. But Johnson turned back to Stephen with a laugh. "Where would the china makers be if no cups were ever broke?" and went on talking about the ivory billed and the pileated woodpeckers. Another man came in, an American. Introductions, though Stephen only caught the Mr. Secretary part of the name. A great deal of conversation, dominated by the harsh, metallic voice of the newcomer. Stephen wanted to observe them, but here was Mrs. Wogan talking to him, very pleased, even triumphant, and so pretty. And now Diana. And presently it appeared to him that a dinner party had been arranged and that he was invited. "I shall so look forward to it," said Diana, as he took his leave. He walked out of the hotel into the fog, fog that thickened as he wandered down towards the harbour, fog in his mind as he tried to interpret the strong and sometimes contradictory emotions that overlapped and mingled in his unreasoning part, grief, disappointment, self-accusation, loss, above all, irreparable loss, a cold void within. A moderate breeze off the shore blew windows in the fog and strange turbulences. Out over the sea it formed again, but on the landward side it was low-lying and patchy. Over the harbour and the navy yard, the upper masts thrust up into clear air, and in many places the hulls of the nearer ships could be seen. Neither Jack Aubrey nor Mr. Herapath, who was sitting with him, had missed a move as the President and Congress got under way. They had been lying at single anchor throughout the morning's flood tide, and now at slack water the President's fife could be heard through the silence, squeaking Yankee Doodle to encourage the hands at the capstan bars. The big frigate, looking perfectly enormous in the fog, moved steadily across the smooth harbour. A freak of the breeze or some odd echo brought the cry, "Up and down, sir," clear to the open window, and it was followed by the crisp orders, "Hook the cat!" "Man the cat!" "Off nippers!" "Away with the cat!" "Hook the fish!" "Away with the fish!" "Haul taut and bit the cable!" In a single movement, the President dropped and sheeted home her topsails, and the Congress did the same.
"There they go,"
murmured Jack as the dim, ghostly sails vanished in the fog. But a moment later both ships set their t'gansails, and these rose well above the bank, so that the frigate's course could be followed far along the intricate turning fairway. As they went, Herapath named the shoals and banks until he came to Lovell's Island, where first the President and then the Congress faded quite away. "At this rate, you should hear the great guns in about an hour," he said, "if the squadron is close in." Jack sighed. The American Commodore had chosen the perfect moment for slipping out, and unless he ran bodily into the Royal Navy, there was very little chance of his being seen. Herapath knew it too, but for some time they both listened, their heads cocked sideways against all reason. "It seems a wicked thing to say," observed Herapath at last. "Wicked to wish for battle and death. Yet if those two ships were taken now, it might bring this accursed war to an end, shorten it in any case, and prevent still more waste of blood and treasure." "Well, sir," he said, standing up. "I must leave you, and I trust I have not stayed too long or tired you. The doctor spoke of 5 minutes and no more."
"Not at all, my dear sir. It was most benevolent in you to come. Your visit has set me up amazingly, and I hope that your good nature may induce you to look in again when business does not tie you to your desk."
When Mr. Hedderpath was gone, Jack listened to the silence for a while, then slipped out of bed and began to bound about the room. He was naturally a very powerful man, and heavy. His strength was coming back, and although his right arm was still painful, its muscles flaccid, his left had grown much more deft with exercise, and now he whirled a ponderous chair over his head, thrusting and cutting, backhand and fore, with a wicked lunge from time to time, and all this in deadly earnest. He was a ludicrous sight, leaping to and fro in his nightshirt, but if he were to obey Stephen's orders to the letter, if he were to lie there a mere hulk, doing nothing to prepare for the day when he might be of some use, his heart would surely break. Presently the Emperor of Mexico joined him, and they pranced and sparred together, but not for long. Captain Aubrey's madness, his savage grunting as he lunged, his red and sweating face, frightened most of his neighbours, and they sensed the savage grief behind his cheerful front. Behind his back they tapped their foreheads, and said that there were limits. This was not a lunatic asylum. Some of the younger nurses were not too well assured either, and when Moria Joyce, a faint slip of a girl that a breeze might carry away, came in and bade him,
"Put it down now, Captain dear, and go back to your bed this minute,"
she did so in a squeak. However, he obeyed at once, and seeing him docile, she went on in a firmer tone,
"You know very well you're not allowed up for shame. Oh, fie, Mr. Aubrey. And three gentlemen to see you, too."
She tweaked him into respectability, smoothed his sheets, put on his nightcap, and whispered,
"Will I fetch you a P.O.T. before they come at all?"
"If you please, my dear," said Jack, "and my razor, too, while you're about it."
He expected some of the Constitution's officers. Mr. Evans was particularly attentive, and the other officers looked in when they were not busy with their gutted ship, or some of the captured English. The daily management of the Asclepia was such that all these people, especially Mr. Evans, were found to be exceptions to the rule that forbade him visitors. But following the chamber pot and the razor, it was Jaleel Brenton who walked in, accompanied by his secretary, and a strong surly man in a cocked hat and a buff waistcoat with brass buttons, presumably a constable or a sheriff's man. Mr. Brenton began in a conciliatory tone. He begged Captain Aubrey not to be agitated. There had been some misunderstanding last time. This visit had nothing to do with the Alice B. Sawyer. It was only to check a few particulars that had not been fully noted down before, and to ask for an explanation of a few sheets that had been found among his papers.
"Our office is required to check all documents found on prisoners of war before any exchange can be contemplated. This, for example," he said, showing a page covered with figures.
Jack looked at it. The figures were in his own hand. The sheet was somehow familiar, though he could not place it. They were not astronomical calculations, nor anything to do with a ship's course, run, or position. Where had Killick dredged it up? Why had he preserved it? Then all at once everything was clear. These were his calculations of the food consumed by the squadron during his second visit to the Cape, kept all these years as something that might come in, something that formed part of that general sense of order and neatness that was part of his character as a sailor.
"These are victualling notes," he said, "compiled according to a system of my own. You will see that they add up to a yearly consumption of £1,085,266 of fresh meat, £1,167,995 of biscuit, and £184,358 of soft tack, £217,813 of flour, 1,066 bushels of wheat, 1,226,738 pints of wine, and 244,904 pints of spirits."
The secretary wrote down the explanation. He and Brenton looked at one another and sniffed.
"Captain Aubrey," said Brenton, "do you expect me to believe that the leopard consumed £1,085,266 of meat and £1,167,995 of biscuits in a year?"
"Who the devil is talking about leopard? And what the devil do you mean, sir, with your 'do you expect me to believe'?"
began Jack. Then he broke off. His face turned to the window, listening intently. Was that distant gunfire, or thunder, or the rolling of a dray down there on the quays? He was absolutely unconscious of the officials, and his tense, remote expression impressed them strangely. Mr. Brenton's eye fell on the razor close by the captain's hand. He checked his hasty answer and continued in an even voice, "Well, we will leave that for the present. Now, what have you to say to this?" holding out another paper. "And pray, what is the significance of Kiki-Wiki?" Jack took it, and his face grew paler still with anger. This was obviously, very obviously, a most private letter. He recognized that as soon as he recognized Admiral Drury's hand.
"Do you mean to tell me," he said in a voice that filled the room, "that you have broken the seal of a private letter, and that you have read what was clearly addressed to the lady alone? As God's my salvation!"
From this point on, the tone rose higher and still higher. Stephen heard them hard at it when he was on the stairs, and when he opened the door, the volume of sound was very great indeed. They fell silent as he paced across the room and took Jack's pulse. Then,
"You must leave at once, sir," he said to Brenton. "That is doctor's orders."
But Brenton had been called a miserable, scrub-faced swab of a civilian and many other things. He had been compelled by sheer moral force to sit silent for minutes on end while Captain Aubrey listened for the guns. He had been humiliated in the presence of his secretary and the useless bailiff's man, and breathing hard he cried that he would not move a step until he had that document, pointing to the Admiral's letter in Jack's hand. Then he let fly a series of passionate and sometimes coherent remarks about his importance in the department's unlimited authority over prisoners, and his powers of coercion.
"Leave the room, sir," said Stephen. "You are doing the patient serious harm."
"I shall not," said Brenton, stamping.
Stephen pulled the bell and desired Bridie to tell the porter to step up. A moment later, without a sound, the immense Indian appeared in the door, filling it entirely.
"Be so good as to show these gentlemen out," said Stephen.
The Indian's cold eye, quite expressionless, moved over them. They were already standing, and now they walked out. But Brenton turned on the threshold, and shaking his fist at Jack, he cried out,
"You have not heard the last of me!"
"Oh, go to the devil, you silly little man," said Jack, wearily.
And then, when the door had closed,
"Officials are much the same all over the world. That reptile might have come straight from the Navy office to badger me about dockets I had forgotten to countersign in the year one. But I tell you what, Stephen, President and Congress have slipped out on the ebb, and I am very much afraid they have got clean away."
"I really cannot have you worried like this," said Stephen,
to whom the sailing of the frigates was at this moment a matter of complete indifference. He was also very much afraid that in common civility Jack would ask after Diana, and in his present state of mind, or rather of confusion, he did not wish to speak of her.
"I shall go and have a word with Dr. Choate," he said.
He walked slowly down the stairs and stepped into the porter's booth to thank the Indian for his services. The Indian listened with something like approval on his face.
"It was a pleasure to me," he said when Stephen had finished. "They were government officials, and I hate government officials."
"All government officials?"
"All American government officials."
"You astonish me."
"You would not be astonished if you were a native of this country, an aboriginal native. Here is a letter for you. It came after you had gone this morning."
Stephen saw that the direction was in Diana's bold, dashing hand, and he put the note into his pocket. If he could as easily have put it out of his mind, he would have been relieved, for although he knew very well that presently he should have to clarify his thoughts and resolve a number of conflicts and apparent contradictions, he did long for a period of calm before doing so. Fortunately, the Indian seemed to be in a mood for conversation. He asked,
"Why do you say ug to me?"
"I looked upon it as a usual greeting in the language of your nation. The Huron is represented as saying ug to the pale face in many authors, French and English. But if I am mistaken, sir, I ask your pardon. My intent was civil, though perhaps inept."
"Most of the Hurons I know have every reason to say ug to the pale face, French, English, or American. In the language that I speak, and I must tell you, sir, that there is an infinity of languages spoken by the original possessors of this continent, ug is an expression of disgust, repulsion, dislike. I had thought of resenting it, but it appeared to me that you meant no offense. And then I have a certain fellow feeling for you. We are, after all, both defeated, both victims of the Americans.
Dr. Choate has told me something of the unhappy Indian wars. He at least is very much opposed to them.
Dr. Choate, yes. There are some good Americans, I admit. My grandfathers, who were at Harvard, at the Indian College, spoke of a Mr. Adams as an excellent man. His mother, however, was a Shawnee, of the same nation, I may add, as the Chief Tecumseh, who is at present helping your people on the Canadian border. Here is Dr. Choate.
"Have you seen Dr. Maturin?" asked Choate. "I am looking for him."
"And I was looking for you, colleague," said Stephen, from the darkness of the booth.
"I have an urgent cystotomy," said Choate, "and as we were speaking of it at our Sunday supper, I am come to beg for your assistance."
"I shall be delighted," said Stephen. And in fact, nothing could have been more timely. An exceedingly delicate operation, but one that he had often carried out, the intense concentration of mind and hand, the moral preoccupation with the bound patient, only too conscious of the knife, these would entirely absorb his spirit, giving it that inner tranquillity where it could work without being thrust and pulled by his reason and his wishes. Yet there was also the night, the unoccupied night, to be considered, and after he had spoken to Dr. Choate about the necessity for keeping the Navy Department away from Jack Aubrey, he asked him for a pint of laudanum.
"The laudanum, by all means," said Choate. "You will find it by the hogshead in the dispensary. As to the Navy Department, I shall do what I can. But these officials have very extensive powers in wartime. I have had notes from them, sharp, peremptory, and authoritative, not to say hectoring."
The operation, performed on an immensely obese, timid patient, was far more intricate than they had expected. Yet finally it was done, and not only was it successful in itself, but there was a real likelihood that the man might live. Stephen went to Jack's room to wash his hands and found him asleep, lying on his back with his injured arm across his chest, and still with that set look of physical suffering and moral shock, not unlike the fainting, earth-coloured patient who had so recently been wheeled away. Stephen knew that nothing but a change of wind would wake him, and having washed, he took the whiskey bottle from its hiding place and drank off half a glass, neat and fierce. No alcohol was allowed in the Asclepia, but the Constitution's officers, particularly Mr. Evans, were aware of this, and the space behind Captain Aubrey's books was filled with rye whiskey, bourbon, and a thin, intensely acrid native wine. He put the whiskey back, dropped the glass, no change in that stern, sleeping face, and withdrew, carrying his own laudanum bottle, green and labelled poison. He had a small room on the inner courtyard, and here he found his lamp already lit and a fire glowing in the hearth. A green-shaded lamp that shone on his table and the papers spread over it, leaving the rest of the room in deep shadow. It was comfortable, a very picture of comfort, and he felt cold, desolate, extraordinarily lonely. Groping in his pocket, he found Diana's note, tossed it onto the table, set his green bottle by it, threw his coat on the bed and sat down, his chair turned half to the table and half to the fire. For many, many years he had been unable to open his mind fully to any man or woman at all, and at times it seemed to him that candor was as essential as food or affection. During most of this period he had used his diary as a kind of surrogate for the non-existent loving ear, a very poor surrogate indeed, but one that had become so habitual as to be almost necessary. He missed it now, the close-written, coded book, and having stared at the fire for a while, he turned full to the table. His indifferent eye fell on the note, addressed in that familiar hand, and he drew a sheet of paper towards him.
"If I no longer love Diana," he wrote, "what shall I do?"
What could he do, with his mainspring, his prime mover, gone? He had known that he would love her forever, to the last syllable of recorded time. He had not sworn it any more than he had sworn that the sun would rise every morning. It was too certain, too evident. No one swears that he will continue to breathe, nor that twice two is four. Indeed, in such a case, an oath would imply the possibility of doubt. Yet now it seemed that perpetuity meant 8 years, 9 months, and some odd days,
while the last syllable of recorded time was Wednesday the 17th of May.
"Can such things be?"
he asked. He knew from examples that this had often happened to other men, and that other men also lost their minds or contracted cancer. Could it be that he was not, as he had implicitly supposed, exceptionally immune?
"Perhaps it is only an intermittence du cœur, no more."
That was extremely probable. A quasi-physical condition, allied to air and diet, anxiety, overwrought anticipation, and 100 other conspiring causes. He wrote another paragraph with instances of strange, apparently inexplicable changes of set purpose, abdications, temporary loss of faith, that could in fact be set down to a vicious habit of body, mere body, the mind's dwelling place, cowardice in brave men whose liver was disordered, the passing mental derangement of parturient women. He added some reflections on the effect of mind upon body, too, such as eczemas, false pregnancies, and the actual production of milk, carefully sanded his last sheet, gathered the others, put them all into the dying fire, watched it flare up, turn and writhe, and fall into black, unmeaning ashes. He was not entirely convinced, and the contradictor in his mind observed that there were many men, and medical men at that, who palpated their tumours and pronounced them benign. But still it was a comfort to his undecided, willing mind, and with it he went to his bed. In the lower part of the building a man was singing, "Oh, oh, the mourning dove," as if his heart would break. Stephen listened to the song, until the rising tide of laudanum sleep engulfed him. The morning broke bright and clear, with a fine breeze in the north-northwest. Jack had been watching since dawn, and before breakfast he saw the expected sail stand into the bay. The light was exceptionally pure, the air transparent, and he soon identified the Shannon. She stood on and on, closer in than he had ever seen any of the blockading squadron, so close that he could see the officer up there with his telescope at the topgallant jacks. He could not swear to it, but he was almost sure that he recognised Philip Broke, who had had the Shannon these last 5 years. Closer still, until at last the gunners on Castle Island threw a high-pitched mortar bomb right over her. At this she wore, but the little figure reappeared on her quarterdeck and mounted to the mizzen crosstrees, the gleaming brass still levelled upon Boston Harbour and the American men of war. A little later she filled and stood out into the offing on the larboard tack, while two hoists of signals broke out high above her topsails. Jack could not read them, but he knew very well what they had to say, and shifting his glass to the horizon, he saw the Shannon's consort bear up, crowd sail, and run fast away east-southeast, right out into the Atlantic.
"Where is the doctor?"
he asked when breakfast appeared.
"Sure he's sleeping yet," said Bridie, "and we will let him lie. He had the cruel hard bloody operation yesterday, and is quite destroyed."
Stephen was lying still when Mr. Evans called on Jack, bringing a friend.
"I will not sit down," said Mr. Evans. "Dr. Choate says you are not allowed visitors. But I could not resist coming up just for 5 minutes with Captain Lawrence, who has a message for you. Allow me to name Captain Lawrence, formerly of the Hornet, now of the Chesapeake. Captain Aubrey of the Royal Navy."
The captains expressed their pleasure, but it was difficult to see much of it on Lawrence's shy, embarrassed face, and the name of Hornet struck all cheerfulness from Jack's. However, he assumed a decent appearance of cordiality, and in spite of their protests, called for coffee and sweet biscuits.
"Or cookies, as I should say," looking at Lawrence with a smile.
He liked the look of him, a big, open-faced man in a white coat, a man with a modest, well-bred air, and obviously a sailor. Lawrence returned the smile. There was clearly a mutual liking in spite of the awkwardness of the situation, and said,
"A little while ago, sir, I had the pleasure of meeting Lieutenant Mowat of your service, and he particularly desired me to wait on you, to bring his respects, to ask how you did, and to tell you that he was coming along very well in the hospital at New York."
Mowat had been one of Jack's midshipmen many years before, and Lawrence had met him in the course of the murderous action in which the Hornet sank the Peacock. As they talked of the young man, who had had three ribs stove in by a splinter of the Peacock's rail, it became clear that Lawrence and he had gone along very well together during their long voyage from the Demerara River, and that Lawrence had been kind to the wounded lieutenant. Jack's heart warmed to him. He was much attached to Mowat. The 5 minutes passed. Another 5. Another pot of coffee. And eventually Choate came in and put them out. Jack returned to his telescope, Evans to the dismantled Constitution, and Lawrence to the Chesapeake. The morning wore on, and part of the afternoon, a brilliant, cheerful day, and at last Stephen came in, still dull and heavy, frowsy from his sleep.
"You look much better, Jack," he said.
"Yes, I feel it, too. Shannon looked into the port this morning, found the birds flown, all except Chesapeake, and—"
"Did you hear that?"
said Stephen, walking to the window.
"The glum-sounding bird?"
"The mourning dove. There she flies. I dreamt of her. Jack, forgive me. I must go. Diana has invited me to dinner with Johnson and Louisa Wogan."
I trust she is well," said Jack.
"Blooming, I thank you. She asked after you most particularly," said Stephen.
There was a pause, but he said no more, and having waited until it was certain that no more would be said, Jack asked,
"Would you like my razor? I stropped it this morning until it would split a hair in 4.
"Oh, no," said Stephen, running his hand over his meagre, bristly face. "This will do very well. I shaved yesterday, or the day before."
"But you have forgot your shirt. There is blood on it. There is blood on the collar and the cuffs."
"Never mind. I will pull up my coat. The coat is perfectly respectable. I took it off for the operation. A very pretty operation, too."
"Stephen," said Jack earnestly, "be a good fellow for once, will you now, and humour me? I should be really unhappy if one of my officers dined in an enemy town looking anything but trim. It could be taken that he was beat and had no pride in the service."
"Very well," said Stephen, and took up the razor.
Trim, shaved and brushed, he hurried through the town. The sharp air cleared his foggy mind, and by the time he reached the hotel, his wits were pretty well at his disposition. He was early, which was a relief to him, for a Presbyterian clock, differing as much in time as in doctrine from the many other clocks of Boston, had given him an unpleasant shock. Indeed, he was so early that there was no one to receive him. "They were still dressing," said the monumental slave, as she showed him into an empty drawing-room. Here he stood for a while, looking at Johnson's pictures. The bald eagle, the Carolina chickadee, his old friend, the black-necked stilt. Then he moved out onto the long balcony to see whether it might command another public clock. Neither he nor Jack possessed a watch. There was one, a great way down the street, but it was obscured by a group of workmen at the far end of the balcony, hauling up lime and sand for some repair, and having craned for some time, he gave it up. What did the time matter, after all? From somewhere along in the other direction, where a curtain streamed from an open window, he heard Diana's voice, raised in that familiar tone of reproach he knew so well. She was passing Johnson under the harrow. In a more gentlemanly mood, Stephen would have moved away at once, but he was not feeling gentlemanly, and after a moment he heard Johnson cry,
"My God, Diana! Sometimes you are as loud as a hog in a gate!"
The voice was strong and exasperated, and it was followed by the slamming of a door. Stephen stepped silently back into the drawing-room, and he was studying the turkey buzzard when Johnson came in, cordial, welcoming, apparently unruffled.
"You are a tolerably good dissimulator, I find," said Stephen to himself, and aloud, "Surely this is a very able man. He gives us not the bird, for no bird ever had this brilliant clarity in every member, but the platonic idea of the bird, the visible archetype of the turkey buzzard."
"Exactly so," said Johnson.
And they talked of the turkey buzzard, and of the bald eagle whose nest Johnson hoped to see on Sunday. It was on a friend's land in the state of Maine, until Mrs. Wogan and Michael Herapath arrived. At the same moment Diana Villiers came in through another door, and Stephen observed that although Wogan was dressed with particular care, Diana won hands down. She was wearing the lightest, purest blue, straight from Paris, and it made Wogan's Boston gown look painstaking and provincial. Furthermore, she had such a riviere of blue-white diamonds around her neck as Stephen had rarely seen, a huge stone in the middle. Even before they sat down to dinner, it was clear to him that there was ill will between Villiers and Wogan on the one hand, and Villiers and Johnson on the other. And when they were at their soup, an admirable bisque de homard, it became equally clear that there was an attachment between Johnson
and Louisa. They did their best to conceal it, but at times they were a little too formal and at others a little too free, the false note continually obtruding. Stephen was well placed to observe them, since the table at which they dined was rectangular, and he occupied the middle of one long side alone, with Herapath and Louisa opposite him, Diana and Johnson at either end, and Wogan on Johnson's right. From Johnson's slightly constrained position, Stephen was pretty sure that he was pressing Wogan's leg, and from Wogan's jolly, lively face, it appeared that she did not dislike it. Stephen was often rather silent and remote at meals. Diana knew this of old, and she spent most of her efforts during the soup and the course that followed on being agreeable to Michael Herapath. Stephen knew that she was barely acquainted with Herapath, and he was surprised by the freedom of her conversation, its rallying, bantering tone, and by her telling an anecdote that was, at the least, ambiguous, a story either witless or indecent. Herapath, too, was surprised, but he was a well-bred creature, and he concealed it, responding in much the same manner, as far as his habits and abilities would allow. This was not very far in the early stages of the meal, but she repeatedly filled his wine glass, and by the turbot he launched into a tale of his own, the only one of the kind he could remember. Yet halfway through it seemed to occur to him that the end bordered too nearly upon the scabrous, and with an anxious glance at Stephen, he tailed away into a very foolish, though innocuous, conclusion. Discouraged, he said no more, and with both her neighbours nearly mute, Diana was obliged to take their entertainment upon herself. Her poise did not desert her for a moment. She filled their glasses yet again. Stephen noticed that she took no unfair advantage, but drank glass for glass with her guests, and gave them a detailed account of a journey to New Orleans. It was not particularly interesting nor amusing, but at least there was a tolerably convincing appearance of conviviality at her end of the table, no awkward silences. Clearly she had had much practice in holding a party together throughout a long dinner, yet from the nature of her conversation it appeared to Stephen that these parties must have consisted of businessmen and politicians, and rather commonplace businessmen and politicians at that. Where was her quick, mordant, wholly spontaneous wit, her delicate turning of a wicked phrase perfectly attuned to her company? Could she be reduced to anecdotes and set pieces when neither he nor Herapath was a politician? She had also acquired a slight American accent, dead against her style. But, on the other hand, had she ever in fact possessed the particular excellences whose absence he now so deplored, or had they existed only in his infatuated mind? No, she had possessed them. His memory was filled with objective proofs of that, and even if it had not been, her physical appearance was convincing evidence. To some degree, every person's face was the creation of the mind behind it, he observed, thinking sadly of his own, and Diana's face and form and movement still reflected much of the fine, dashing, elegant spirit he had known. It occurred to him that she had spent these last few years entirely among men, seeing no women apart from a few, like Louisa Wogan. She spoke rather as men, and somewhat raffish, moneyed, loose-living men, speak when they are alone together. "She has forgotten the distinction between what can and what cannot be said," he reflected. "A few more years of this company, and she would not scruple to fart." A delicate distraction, that between true spirit on the one hand, and boldness and confidence on the other. He was pursuing this line of thought when a fresh decanter appeared, and Diana, visibly irritated by an indiscretion on the part of Johnson and Louisa, cried, "God's my life! This wine is corked! Really, Johnson, you might give your guests something they can drink." Extreme concern on the black butler's face. A glass hurried down to the other end of the table. Silence, and then the verdict, delivered with studied mildness.
"Surely not, my dear. It seems quite sound to me. Take a glass to Dr. Maturin. What do you say to it, sir?"
"I am no great judge of wine," said Stephen, "but I have heard that very occasionally the mouthful just round the cork may have an ill taste, while the rest of the bottle is excellent. Perhaps that is the case here."
It was a poor shift, but enough for minds willing to avoid an éclat. The decanter was replaced, and the conversation became more general. Herapath struck in with some considerations on the inevitable delays of the press. Presently they were talking about the publication of his book, and it was pleasant to see Louisa Wogan's eagerness as they discussed the character in which it was to be printed, and the size and quality of the paper. She certainly had an affection for Herapath, but perhaps it was more the affection of a sister rather than of a mistress, a somewhat Pharaonic sister. Stephen, too, aroused himself to a sense of his social duty, and with the roast he told Diana and Herapath about the voyage in the cutter after La Flèche had burned, their consuming hatred for a ship that passed without seeing them, their insatiable appetite for biscuit when they were taken aboard the ill-fated Java at last. "Between breakfast and dinner," he said, "I saw Captain Aubrey eat 3.5 pounds, taking a draught of water at 8-ounce intervals, and I kept pace with him, crying out at their perfect suavity, pitying Lucullus for not having known ship's biscuit before the high weevil stage, for Java was only 4 weeks out." Diana asked him about Jack's present state of health, and when he had answered, she said, in a momentary pause, "Do please remember to give him my love." To his surprise, Stephen saw Johnson stiffen, sit straight, presumably detaching himself from Wogan, and ask, "Who is this gentleman to whom you are sending your love, my dear?" in a voice that endeavoured, without much success, to hide its strong displeasure. "Captain Aubrey," said Diana, raising her head with that fierce, beautiful gesture that Stephen remembered so well. "A very distinguished officer in His Majesty's service, sir." But then, breaking the tension, she added meekly, "He is my cousin by marriage. He married Sophie Williams."
"Oh, Captain Aubrey," said Johnson. "Yes, the gentleman I am to see this afternoon."
The meal drew to an end. Diana and Louisa Wogan retired. "I wonder how they will like each other's company," thought Stephen, as he held the door for them to pass. The men sat for a while, talking of Boston's subscription for the Muscovites who had suffered from the burning of their city, and of the attitude of the King of Prussia.
"It is shocking how little our public men know about conditions in Europe," observed Johnson,
and before they went into the drawing-room, he said privately,
"Dr. Maturin, if you are not engaged this evening, I should very much like to have a word with you. This afternoon I must see Captain Aubrey, an official matter to do with his exchange, and some Frenchmen, but I do not suppose it will take very long. Could you perhaps sit drinking tea with Mrs. Villiers until I return?"
"I should be very happy," said Stephen.
He and Herapath walked into the drawing-room, where Diana and Louisa were sitting at some distance from one another, silently smoking long, thin cigars. Herapath was a little unsteady on his legs, a little elevated in his spirits, and he thought fit to recite his version of a Tang poem dealing with the emotions of a Chinese princess married for political reasons to a barbarian, the leader of a horde that lived brutishly in Outer Mongolia. And in his enthusiasm, he had a tendency to stumble over the words. The women listened to him, Louisa with amused and kindly tolerance, Diana with a certain shade of contempt. Stephen did not listen at all. He had felt a good many miseries in his time, but none to be compared to this cold vacancy within. His observation of her had confirmed his suspicions of the day before, and provided reasons for the first instinctive feeling. He did not love Diana Villiers any more, and it was death to him. Something in her essence had changed, and the woman who poured out the tea and talked was a stranger, all the more a stranger because of their former intimacy. The evident change was that anger and ill-humour, disappointment and frustration had hardened her. Her face was lovely, yet its expression in repose was not amiable. Louisa Wogan did not possess a tithe of Diana's style or beauty. She was on a smaller scale entirely, but her cheerfulness, her humour, and her willingness to be pleased made a painful contrast. The important change was far more profound, however. It was as though Diana's spirit had diminished, and her courage had begun to fail, if indeed it had not already broken. To be sure, her position was difficult, and extraordinary courage would have been needed to deal with it. But then he had always looked upon Diana as a woman, a being, possessed of extraordinary courage. Without courage, she was not Diana. But then again, he said, his mind changing direction, there was the physical aspect to be considered. If costiveness could affect a man's courage, how much more might an adverse phase of the moon affect a woman's? He looked secretly at her face for signs that would support this notion, and indeed for encouragement, but to his dismay he found that his intelligence rejected the moon and all its influence, and merely recorded an impression that the high carriage of her head, the straightness of her back he had so much admired and for so long, now appeared slightly exaggerated, the effect of indignation, of a sense of ill usage. If, as he supposed, her spirit had been damaged, and if from strong she had become weak, then the common vices of weakness would naturally ensue. It would not be surprising to find petulance, ill-temper, and even, God forbid, self-pity, falseness, a general debasement. Herapath's voice had changed from the solemn mooing of recital. It must have changed some time before without Stephen's noticing it, since the present discussion, or rather argument, between him and Louisa about Caroline's feeding time and the proper persons to be entrusted with it was already well advanced. In time, Herapath, supported by Diana, prevailed, and there was a general move towards the door.
"Louisa is such a devoted mother," said Diana. "You would swear she was made for feeding babies. I'm sure it must be her greatest delight. Is it not, Louisa?"
With some warmth, Louisa observed that only those women who possessed babies could appreciate these things at their just value, and Stephen was tortured by the thought that Diana might answer with some reflection upon Louisa's manner of coming by her child. But she only said,
"Oh, my dear, before you go into the street, I must just tell you that your petticoat is showing. It was disgraceful of me not to have mentioned it before dinner, though, to be sure, no one minds such things in a nursing mother." "Lord, Stephen," she said, returning, "I am so sorry to have inflicted such a boring dinner party on you. You have enough to bear as it is, but at least now we can talk."
She talked with the absolute openness and freedom that Stephen had so envied, for there at her side, as she supposed, was the loving, receptive ear, and certainly he listened with grave attention and concern. His friendship for her was quite intact, and it contained a large element of tenderness. Her relationship with Johnson had been uneasy from the start. Even if it had not been for the interminable business of his divorce, their connection could never have lasted. He was violent, dangerous, and he could be perfectly ruthless. At ordinary times he was ill-tempered, far too rich for his own good. He was a philanderer, and his behaviour to his blacks was revolting.
"I suppose the actual sight, the daily experience of slavery must be very hard to bear," said Stephen, "particularly on the industrial scale of a large plantation." "Oh, as for that," said she, shrugging, "it seems to me natural enough. There were quantities of them in India, you know. I should have said his black women. Any number of the mulatto children about the house in Maryland were his, and the older ones were his half-brothers or sisters. And there were a couple of Octoroon girls, cousins, I dare say, who looked at me in such an odiously familiar, knowing way I could not bear it. I felt like something that had been bought. The fellow was a perfect parish bull."
"The parish bull slumbers in most of us, I fear."
"It never slumbers in Johnson at any moment, I do assure you. And at the same time he is absurdly jealous, a perfect Turk. All he lacks is a beard and a turban and scimitar," she said, with a ghost of her old smile. "None of the black girls he has tossed the handkerchief to is ever allowed to marry, and he made me such scenes for talking to another man that you would never believe. I really think he would kill me and you, too, if he saw me do this."
She laid her hand affectionately on his.
"My God, Maturin," she said, pressing it, "what a relief it is to have somebody you can really trust and rely upon."
It was after one of these scenes that she had left him and came to London. He followed her. He was good, quiet, kind, full of promises of reform. He showed her lawyers' letters that made it seem that his divorce was very near.
"And he gave me these diamonds," she said,
unclasping the necklace and tossing it onto the couch, where it blazed and glittered like a phosphorescent wake.
"They were his mother's, and he had them reset. The big one in the middle is called the Begum. I suppose it is disgraceful to admit that they had an influence on me, but they did. Perhaps most women like diamonds."
It was in London, or rather in their precipitate flight from London, that she learnt that Johnson was connected with American intelligence. But even then she had never imagined for a moment that what he did was in any way directed against England. She thought it was to do with stocks and shares and government funds in Europe, particularly as at that time there was a general idea that the United States would go to war with France. He terrified her, however, by saying that she was implicated, that government would take her up and hang her for having passed papers on to Louisa Wogan, so like a fool she agreed to go back with him to America. She had received letters for Louisa, and she had passed them on. But she had thought it was only an intrigue until Louisa was arrested, and she herself was taken to the Home Office and questioned for hours on end. She lost her head and ran off with Johnson. It was the silliest thing she'd ever done in her life. There she was in an enemy country, and the fellow had the infernal effrontery to expect her to help him in his work against her own people, and to be pleased when Royal Navy ships were taken.
"Oh, it went to my heart, Stephen, straight to my heart. Every one of those frigates we were so proud of, and there were three of them without a single victory, and the Americans do so crow, and I see English officers walking about, prisoners of war. It is unspeakable."
"Did you not become an American citizen?"
"Oh, I signed some foolish papers because they said it would make the divorce easier. But how could a miserable bit of paper make any difference? Johnson is a very clever man, but sometimes he can be unbelievably stupid. To expect the daughter of a soldier who served the king all his life, brought up among soldiers, married to a soldier, to work against her own country. Perhaps he thinks he is Adonis and Byron and Croesus all rolled into one, and no woman can resist him. He still thinks he can persuade me because I write some of his letters to the Frenchmen. But he never shall. Never, never, never."
"Is his work important?"
"Yes, I was amazed. I thought he was just a rich man fooling about, a dilettante. But not at all. He is perfectly passionate about it. Spends far more money than the government gives him. Sold an outlying plantation in Virginia only last month. He advises the Secretary of State, and he has a whole swarm of people working under him. Louisa Wogan was one of them, and will be again. Oh, Stephen, I cannot bear it. I am desperate. How can I get out?"
He stood up, walked to the window, and stood there with his hands behind his back, staring down the balcony at the workmen. Her account was perfectly true. She was candid, but not entirely so. She said nothing about the fact that she was utterly at a loss, finding herself in the position of a woman who is being, if not discarded, then at least supplanted. Hitherto it had been she who gave the dismissal, and the new role was beyond her, and she was so very much distressed, so deeply disturbed, that her intuition gave her no hint of his present state of heart. Then again, she was certainly afraid of Johnson. Her position was indeed quite desperate. Turning, he said,
"Listen, my dear, you must marry me. That will make you a British subject again, so that you can return to England. Jack and I are to be exchanged in a day or so, and you will come back with us as my wife. It will be a purely nominal marriage, a mariage blanc, if you wish."
"Oh, Stephen!"
she cried, springing up with such a look of gratitude and trust and affection that it filled his heart with guilt and remorse.
"I knew I could always rely on you."
She embraced him, pressed him close, and he concealed his lack of physical emotion by pressing her closer still. Then she stood away. Her face fell, and she said,
"No, oh no, I was forgetting. They believe Aubrey had something to do with intelligence, that he palmed some papers off on Louisa when she was aboard the Leopard. God knows if they are right. I no longer know what to think about anybody. I should never, never have believed Louisa was a spy. But if they are, God help him, in Johnson's hands, there will be no exchange."
Johnson could be heard calling out in remarkably bad French some way down the corridor, and they had time to recover an appearance of indifference before he came in. He excused himself for having been so long, and catching sight of the diamond necklace, he picked it up.
"I was just going to put it away," said Diana.
It flashed and sparkled as he poured it from hand to hand, and an infinity of tiny prismatic lights raced across the ceiling like swarms and swarms of shooting stars.
"Yes, do," he said. "I'm not quite satisfied with the clasp, and I should like the case to carry it in."
Diana left the room without a word, carrying the necklace, and Johnson said,
"I saw Captain Aubrey this afternoon. He spoke so handsomely of you, Dr. Maturin, and we got along very well together. There had been some unfortunate misunderstanding with a gentleman who had questioned him before, but that was soon resolved. I rather think they were on the wrong track altogether, and that the business will soon be settled. Captain Aubrey is the most complete British sea officer, the kind that taught our men their trade. But he puzzled me once or twice. Would it be indiscreet to ask who the Admiral Crichton to whom he compared you may be? I cannot remember any such name among Lord Nelson's companions.
And what can he have meant by saying that Napoleon was killing the golden calf in Russia? I did not like to linger, because really he has been so shockingly knocked about, and Dr. Choate insisted that I should not fatigue him.
The Crichton in question was no doubt the ingenious Scotchman of some 2 centuries ago, who spoke so many languages and who was called the Admirable for his shining parts. Captain Aubrey has long been persuaded that he served in the Royal Navy. As for the golden calf, I can only hazard the guess that there may have been some confusion between the error of the Israelites and the goose of our childhood that laid those golden eggs, poor bird.
Ah, I see. Yes. So that he meant that Napoleon was ill-advised in attacking the Tsar. Just so. What is your opinion, Dr. Maturin?
I really know so very little of these things. I only hope that all this useless slaughter and destruction will soon come to an end.
With all my heart, said Johnson, you are a man of peace, and so am I. Yet it does appear to me that if only there were a clearer understanding between the opposing forces, more true knowledge of the real aims and potentialities of each, that peace would come much sooner. And as I observed not long ago, we in the States are quite shockingly ignorant of the finer points of the situation in Europe. For example, it was only recently that we learned of the existence of various organizations among the Catalans of northeast Spain who are determined to break away from the domination of Castile. We had supposed that there was only one. And then, of course, there is the state of affairs in Ireland. There are so many points of that kind where I should be so grateful for your advice.
I am afraid, sir, that the advice of a plain naval surgeon would be of little use to you.
You are not quite the plainest of naval surgeons, said Johnson, looking amused. And after a pause he went on, I know something of your publications, your reputation, and your activities, your scientific activities. And Louisa Wogan has told me of your distress at the prospect of a war between the States and the United Kingdom, and of your, let us say, impatience at the English government's conduct in Ireland. But even if you were no more than a plain naval surgeon, you are a European, a much-travelled European, and your advice would be valuable. After all, our ends are essentially the same, the restoration of a just and lasting peace.
I fully take your point, and I have much sympathy with what you say, said Stephen, but I must beg to be excused. In spite of my esteem for you personally, sir, I must point out that we are technically at war, and that if my advice should be of the least value to you, then I should be comforting the enemy, which, as you will agree, has a most unpleasant sound. You must forgive me.
A man of your intelligence will never be the prisoner of words, mere lawyer's words at that. No, no, pray reflect on what I have said. It is only on points quite unconnected with the Navy that I should like to consult you.
We have it on excellent authority that a man cannot serve 2 masters, said Stephen, smiling.
No, replied Johnson, returning the smile. But he can serve an end that transcends both. Dear doctor, I will not take your refusal.
He pulled the bell.
Ask the gentleman to come in, he said to the servant, and to Stephen, forgive me a moment. I just have to hand a letter to these Frenchmen.
Dubreuil walked in, followed by the tall Pontécanet. Stephen recognized Dubreuil at once. He had, after all, watched the man in and out of the embassy at Lisbon, and from a maid's window opposite the ministry in Paris, although he was almost certain that Dubreuil knew nothing of him except by description. Dubreuil made a distant bow, which Stephen returned. Pontécanet asked him how he did. There were no introductions, and the Frenchman, having received an envelope, retired.
"Did you notice that man?" asked Johnson.
The small, unnoticeable man. You might not think so, but he is the most devilish creature. They had an agent on the Canadian border who thought it more profitable to be paid by both sides. They brought him down here, and what they did to him I will not even attempt to describe, although you are a medical man. The sight of the body, I do assure you, haunted me for weeks. They have notions I cannot possibly approve, although they may be efficacious, and it was a gross violation of our sovereignty.
But in these critical times we cannot be as rigid with our French colleagues as I could wish. However, let us meet tomorrow. There are certain formalities to do with Captain Aubrey's exchange that we can deal with. I'm sure he should not be worried in his present lamentable condition. And when you have slept upon it, I hope you will not object to my consulting you on a few points of purely European politics.